Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Questlove Supreme. I'm your host, Questlove, and we have Team Supreme with us. Laia, hello, how are you today?
I am doing well, sir. How are you?
I'm great. Is that a new microphone?
No, man. It's like every day, every time we do the show, you look at me more.
Notice something new. Yeah,
it's not new, though.
It's like we're meeting for the first time.
Exactly. Just look at me. I'm here.
It's like we didn't know each other since we were 13.
Don't start that.
Sugar Steve, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Nice to see you, Amir. Nice to see you, Team.
That sounds like a deflection. How you really doing, Steve?
I'm a mess.
Tell the truth, Steve.
We're all a mess.
All right. Now we're going to rename you, Steve.
Sugar's a high. Hi, yeah, Sugar Steve.
Yes, sugar's. Double Sugar Steve.
Not Steve, funny.
Can we start calling Glucose Steve?
You cannot do this on my watch, man. I'm not. Yeah. Because I'm going to.
It's all right. Thank you for your concern. I'm going cold turkey on raw cookie dough. I'm going to be fine.
You are too old to be eating that. That's crazy.
Oh, my God. I'm done with all that. I'm done with it.
Okay. All right, Steve. I'm now going to implement some sugarless snacks in your diet.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
It works for me. It'll work for you. Bill, how's life?
Everything's good. I can't complain.
Fontigolo.
I'm cooling, man.
Everything fine?
Yeah, man, everything's cool over here. We just chilling. Everybody's we staying low, staying healthy. We good.
That's good. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I will say, probably during the pandemic, not only for me, well, I will probably speak for the team. We probably watched or revisited more content from film and TV in the pandemic than we normally have. And I will personally say that I have a new appreciation for the teams that make film. It's not just about the director or just about a particular actor or actress that you like. You have to consider the producer, the cinematographer, the lighting director, and most importantly, the editing of the film. And so I will say that as far as our guest is concerned, started out his ascent into the professional career of filmmaking as an editor. First of all, in the groundbreaking, what I call one of the first hip-hop films, Style Wars, not to mention as editor for some of my favorite Spike Lee films like Mo Better Blues, Jungle Fever, Juice, Clockers, Girl Six, his documentaries, Four Little Girls, both of the what I would call the New Orleans documentaries for the Levees. Not to mention, also, I didn't realize Hooker's on the Point. I didn't realize that.
Wow.
But you
pimps your on the stroll, holes on a roll.
Yes.
I the see game changed, but the name remains the same. Meet Candy. She's so dandy.
Oh my God, Fonte.
Did you like memorize this film?
Dude.
You
don't understand, bro. Me and my homies used to watch, because this is like I'm in like fucking high school, right? So me and my homies would watch Hookers at the Point, and then we'd come to school the next day and know all the, like, we'd be saying all the lines in class and shit.
I would like to say that Hookers at the Point transcends all things. I also watched Hookers at the Point. The next day, went to tell my friends about Hookers at the Point, like in a different way, but I definitely watched Hookers at the Point.
This makes it official that Bill and Fontigolo are the same person.
Yes,
absolutely.
Yes.
Oh, God.
The same music.
No, dude.
All day.
Wait, guys, hang on. Not to mention his powerful Shirley Chisholm 17
yes,
documentary.
Yes, thank you, Amir.
And his forays into directing documentaries.
Yes.
Eyes on the Prize, which I, especially in light of Black Messiah and Jesus, Jesus and the Black Messiah movie, him directing the Eyes on the Prize film, Eyes on the Prize 2, of which
the
footage of that film was used in that particular film. But there's also the Mr. Soul documentary and his latest MLK FBI, which weighs heavily into explores the we can say the harassment and the monitoring of the J. Edgar Hoover led Bureau into the life and kind of the affairs of Martin Luther King Jr. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to Questlove Supreme, Sam Pollard. Thank you, man.
My pleasure.
Okay, now back to Hookers on the Point.
So. Oh, my God.
Yes. What happened to Pierre?
The classiest intro ever for you, sir, I'm sure.
Terrible.
You've been out here fucking. I ain't been fucking.
Oh, yeah, more.
Anyway. I know the whole.
You really memorized it, man. Brent Owens.
Yeah, this is Brent Owens. Scary to me.
Yeah, man.
I could have a stage reading.
Wow, man. You had the tone and everything down. Wow.
It made an impact.
So how's it going right now? How are you doing?
I'm good, man. I'm pretty good. You know, I'm working on a new film about Arthur Ashe.
Wow.
Hey, yes. I'm
hoping to finish that by June and, you know, developing some other stuff.
Yeah, I'll let our listeners know that you and I are actually partnering up for hopefully, you know, in the near future, we'll have the definitive film about the Negro League.
Right.
You nice. And I have been pounding the pavement together, pitching to various companies and whatnot. So that's very exciting for me. I'll ask. As I said at the top, I didn't realize how important or how instrumental editors are to a film. You know, a lot of the times, like people that aren't, you know, film buffs or whatnot, they just tend to think that the director has complete control of everything, the screenwriting, the everything. But, you know, I almost feel as though the editor has the hardest job of setting the tone. So I'll ask you, first of all, as an editor, the general rule that I've been taught is that once a film is done, you're basically to hand your entire footage to your editor and kind of sight unseen, just let them do their thing and not micromanage. Is that necessarily true, or like what is the true job of an editor?
Well, I would say this. I would say in the fiction world, you know, when you're doing editing a fiction film, you're given a script and, you know, and everything that they shoot in that script, you basically know exactly how to put it together. Now it can change when you're sitting down editing sequences together, but usually most directors leave you alone with a fiction film to sort of put together what we call the first rough cut, you know, and then they come in and you give reactions to everything you've cut, ask for changes and stuff. So that becomes a director's cut, you know, so that's how it works in fiction film. In the documentary world, one of the reasons I became such a lover of documentaries is because as an editor, specifically what you're speaking to, Amir, many times when I was beginning to edit a documentary, the director would come in with lots of footage and say, I have this great idea to tell this story about hip hop and break dancing and rap music. And I'm not quite sure the order, but here's the footage. And then they'd walk away and they'd give me 4, 5, 6 months, 7 months sometimes to create the sequences. You know, and you're basically trying to, in some ways, as the editor, read the director's mind to get a sense of what the director's looking for as you're shaping the sequences. Now, sometimes in the documentaries, the director comes in or he calls in and he wants to see sequences to see where you're going before you put the whole thing together. And you show it to him or her and they react to it and you make changes. But really, in the terms of the documentary, it's really the editor's medium. The editor becomes, with the documentary, much more so than with the features, they become sort of the surrogate directors because they're shaping the story arc. They're shaping the tone, the emotional tone. They're shaping the sort of the ups and downs of the film as it unfolds. So, you know, as a young editor, that's what I loved. I mean, I was pretty shy back then. So the idea of being a director didn't entice me. It was the idea that I had all this footage. And, you know, the big thing about editing documentaries is that you can hit a home run, or you can hit a ball that just pop out and you could completely fail. And, you know, that's a responsibility that as a documentary editor you have to take on, understanding that sometimes a director will walk in and say to you after they see your first cut, Sam, this is exactly what I was thinking about. This is my vision of the film. You found my vision. Or they can walk into the editing room and they'll say, after they look at your cut, they'll say, oh, Sam, that's terrible. You didn't understand anything I was trying to do with this footage. We're going to have to start all over again. You know, so
damn, really?
I've been on both sides of those poles, you know?
Yikes.
Okay. When I was young, I would be like, oh my God, I'm terrible. Nobody loves me. It doesn't work. Yeah. As I've gotten older, that's part of the process. You realize that's part of the process. You're never going to make it right the first time. That's why it's called re-editing and re-editing. I mean, you listed the films I've edited for Spike. And even on the feature films, I never made a cut that Spike completely said, oh, it's 100% work. Oh, Sam, no change. It just doesn't work that way. There's always going to be changes.
Has there ever been a time where in your editing career where, you know, like you said, a director comes to you and says, hey, I want to tell this story about breakdancing and hip hop or whatever. And so they give you all this footage. But then during your editing, you kind of start putting together and you see, I know this is what he thinks this is about, but I think there's a bigger story that can be told that maybe he's missing, or maybe now when I have all these pieces together, he may think that it's about, you know, just hip hop and breakdancing, but there is probably a deeper narrative that is starting to evolve as I put this together. Has that ever happened?
Yeah. How much leeway are you given?
All the time. That happens all the time. And as an editor, as a creative editor, you have to be open to the idea of seeing the story in a different way and taking on that responsibility. You say to yourself, should I show it to the director this way because I think it works? Or should I say, well, I'm not sure it works. Let me show it to the way he asked me to do it. I always had the tendency to show it to them the way I thought it would work better. You know,
gotcha.
And that's part of the gamble. Sometimes you show it to them and they say, yep. Sometimes you show it to them and they say, no. That's how it works.
I just wonder, for MLK FBI, was it the decision to not show the folks who were commentating's face, was that a Sam decision, or was that just like something that y'all had to establish? Because I was noticing that was like a big difference in a lot of the documentaries that I see these days.
In that case, that was a Sam decision before we even shot. I had said to the producer, Ben Hedin, that I didn't want anybody on camera. I wanted to all be voiceover, because I had seen a film that Amir was involved in, he did the music for, Black Power Mixtape. Mm-hmm. You know, and they had nobody on camera in that film. And I remember that. So when I got to do this one, I said, we won't show anybody on camera. We're going to do it all voiceover. And, you know, that was a gamble, but I was willing to take it. Mm-hmm. You know,
what was the artistic kind of choice? What drove that decision?
You know, I felt that this particular film, I wanted people who were either close confidants with Dr. King or who were stories who could talk about the mythology, the built and growing mythology of the FBI. And I just felt like I wanted people to not see people on camera. I just wanted them to be immersed in the footage and hear the voiceover.
That's what it happens, is.
What happens when you put people on camera, sometimes it can break the emotional momentum of the footage, you know? So I felt like, no, keep them off camera, keep the footage, keep the archival footage front and center so people will engage. Now, as you saw in the epilogue, we did show the faces when they sort of wrapped up about what they thought about the tapes being released in 2027. Now, I would say that wasn't my idea. I thought the epilogue should be all voiceover too, but the editor, this was Laura Tomaselli, she had the idea we should put them on camera. So when I saw the cut and she put them on camera, I said, wow, I wish I could take credit for this, but she was really helpful.
Yeah, because it was a payoff. It was like,
it was a great emotional payoff.
Yeah.
You know. I fell down my own rabbit hole and just happened to click on Black Power Mixtape.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently I won a Swedish Oscar.
You didn't know that you did?
I didn't know they had Oscars.
I'm like, what?
Apparently I won a Gold Gulbadage Award.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm going to have to. Yeah. Yeah, this is the second time I found out I won something and wasn't told. Mm. This very podcast won a Webby, and we weren't told. So there's a history of that, people. Yeah, right. Questlove Supreme, we win an awards and don't even know it.
Yeah,
trying to keep us down, the man. You know about that, Sam.
Yeah, I know.
Keeping us humble, Sam. What brought you to the film world or a passion? I'll say that mostly, like, from my point of view, my observation. People easily jump into music. People easily jump into sports. But I rarely hear of people successfully having a passion for film and jumping into that world and like making a living and having a fruitful career in it. So what started yours?
Well, here I was, a young man who grew up in East Harlem. I was going to Baruch College with the majoring in marketing. I was in my junior year. And one day I looked around and I saw myself being miserable, taking all these marketing and statistics courses. And I said, Jesus, I gotta find some after school activity to do. I can't handle this. So I walked across the street to the counselor's office. I saw my counselor, this wonderful African-American lady. And I said, I was looking for an after school internship. And she said, well, what are your interests? And I said, one of the things I really loved growing up in my teens, I loved watching all these old Hollywood movies. You know, I watched all those Warner Brothers and MGM and Columbia Pictures and RKO movies, RKO studio movies, and I loved them. So she said there was a PBS station in New York City, WNET, in 1968, after Dr. King's assassination, this felt it was important to get more people of color behind the scenes, shooting, editing, taking sound, producing. And she said that they had a one-year workshop every year from 68. This was 1971. And they had, on Tuesday nights, they would have these classes from 6 to 10 where professional editors, professional cinematographers, professional sound people, professionals, producers would come in and teach you about the process of making television and films. And then on the weekends, you would go out with your crew, group of people. There was like 15 of us. They would pair us off. We'd go out and shoot little films. And then we'd come back to an editing space and we'd learn how to edit these films together. So when she first proposed that to me, I said, my response to her was, well, I like watching movies, but I don't really care about how they make them. You know, I don't care. But she was very persuasive. She got me to have an interview and I got accepted to this program. And I did that for 1 year. And the thing that I got attracted to wasn't the shooting, wasn't the producing, wasn't the sound mixing. It was the editing. I could be in a dark room. I could
by yourself.
Nobody mm-hmm. could see me make mistakes. If I made a mistake, I could undo the footage and splice it back together because we were cutting on film. And at the end of that workshop, I said I was interested in, they said they'd try to find you a job. And I said I was interested in finding a job in editing. And one day I was working, the summer of 72, I was working at a marketing firm on 33rd and Park Avenue. And my mother called me and said that this production manager had called and said they were looking to interview me to be an apprentice editor on a low budget feature film called Ganja and Hess, directed by Bill Gunn.
Bill Gunn.
And most of the crew was African American, but the editor was this Jewish guy. His assistant was this young white girl from Kentucky. So I went and had an interview with this editor, and I got hired in 1972. My first job.
And then Spike, he remade that as The Sweet Blood of Jesus.
He did it as The Sweet Blood of Jesus. Yeah.
Okay. You mentioned WNET earlier. Were you interning there or just?
They had the workshop there. The workshop was part of NET. You know,
did you have any interaction with? You directed
Mr. Soul,
but right. The original Soul show, like, did you work at all?
No, I didn't work on it at all. It was, you know, it had been canceled by the time I got into that program. It was 69 to 72. So by the time I left the program, it had been canceled. I used to watch it all the time. You know, I used to watch it all the time.
Well, they had like a lot of black productions. I remember,
a
show called Rebop or?
Rebop was not in New York. It was in Massachusetts.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but in New York, they had Black Journal. They had Soul. They had Like It Is, Gil Noble on ABC. Bill Grease was the producer on Soul. And some of the first African-American producers who worked for Black Journal was like Tony Batten and St. Clair Bourne, you know, who became one of my mentors later in my career.
That's what I wanted to know. Like, who were your... contemporaries at least starting out with you at the same time. Like I know that what's his name? Director.
Ernest Dickerson.
No, what's her name's father?
Stan Lathan.
That's
an insult. Right. What's her name's father?
Stan was already directing at Soul in Black Journal by the time I got to the business. Sam was making.
Okay. But what I wanted to know was there like a crew of you as young black upstarts trying to get into film, or was it just all of you independently kind of treading in?
The program I was in was like 15 of us. We're all African American. And some of us, you know, got into the business. Some people went to CBS, some people went to ABC, some people freelanced like I did. That was the crew I was with, you know. And then after I did the 6 months as an apprentice editor on Gage and Hess, that same editor who hired me then made me his assistant. And I was his assistant for 3 years, from 22, 23, 24, 25 years old.
George Bowers?
No. I met George right around 75. I had sort of was looking for a job, and I went to this editing room, and George Bowers was editing a film called Countdown of Cassini, directed by Ossie Davis, with Ruby Dee and Greg Morris from Mission Impossible. George turned me on to doing a little film. He got me hired to do a little film about the first three black mayors of major cities: Tom Bradley of Los Angeles, Coleman Young of Detroit, and Maynard Jackson of Atlanta. And it was being directed by David Parks, Gordon Parks' son.
Wow.
And I edited that when I was like 26 years old. And then George hired me to edit some films for him. And then he moved out to California to direct some low-budget features. And in 1980, I went out to L.A. and edited for him a film. I don't know if you remember this film, Body and Soul, with Leon Isaac Kennedy.
And yes.
Yeah. I know this film. I edited that film in 1980.
Yeah, I know this film. I was at the time in the 70s. Did you like? What was your kind of your what in your mind would have been your end game, or your goal to get to at the time when you were sort of finding your way in the early 70s?
My end game was I had this dream of becoming a big time feature film editor. You know, I wanted to edit feature films. That was the big time. That was the goal at, you know, 1979, 77, 78. I was editing docs, but I wanted to be a big time feature editor. And George let me edit Body and Soul. And then I went back to New York and I was editing more docs. And then George did this film in 1984 with a young Johnny Depp called Private Resort. That I edited in California. Wow. You remember that film too, man?
I don't remember that one. I've never heard of that one.
It feels like one of those films that would come on Prism or Showtime.
It
was on Showtime.
Oh, you got it, Steve? That's funny.
Yeah, I've seen Private Resort.
And then I came back to New York, did some other films, and then I got hired by Henry Hampton in 87 to work on Eyes 2. Mm-hmm. And I was working on Eyes 2 for like a year shooting and my first time producing. And then one day I was living in the Back Bay section of Boston. And my son, who was 10 years old at the time, the phone rang, he picked it up. And he said, "Dad, it's Spike Lee." And I had just seen Do the Right Thing in the movies. And I said, "Jason, what are you messing with me for, man? Spike Lee didn't call me. He's not calling me." And he said, "No, Dad, it's Spike Lee." So I got on the phone. And sure enough, it was Spike. And a buddy of mine who was his production manager on Do the Right Thing had recommended me to Spike to cut Mo' Better Blues.
Oh, okay.
And I turned him down.
Wait, what?
Wow.
I turned him down the first time. Because I was still in the middle of Eyes on the Prize too. So I said, "Spike, I'm busy. Thanks for the call, but I had to say no." And then St. Clair Bourne had done a documentary about Do the Right Thing called Making Do the Right. And I had worked for Saint in the early 80s, cutting two or three films. And then Saint recommended me to Spike. And about 6 weeks later, Spike called me again, asked me again to do Mo' Better. And this time I said, "Well," he said, "let's meet up." And we were both going up to the Vineyard, to Oak Bluffs, and separately. And we met up at Oak Bluffs. We went to a little coffee shop. We spent a half hour in that coffee shop. And I basically talked myself into taking the job. Because he didn't talk much.
Okay, well, you said that and you know, you wanted to concentrate on your one project, and you said the word no, which I clearly don't know the meaning of that word. How many projects can you realistically juggle? Okay, I'll rephrase that. How many projects should you juggle any calendar year if you are an editor?
You can't do but maybe one or two.
So if you're actively working on a project,
it's very hard. If you're actually physically editing, it's very hard to do another film unless you know. Listen, when I was a young man, I would do two films, edit two films. I would edit probably somebody's film all day in a day. That'd be my prime time job. You know, I'd come home. I remember working in Washington on a series called Smithsonian World, and I would edit all day from like 9 to 6. I'd go home and have some dinner. And Saint, I was doing a film for Saint, a little dramatic film for Saint. And I would edit for Saint from, I would edit in my apartment on the steam deck from like 7 till midnight. So yeah, I would edit two films, you know. That's when I was a young man.
Yeah, we don't do that type of shit no more.
When it switched over to digital, did that help at all?
Oh, I could probably do three.
Oh, shit.
I didn't sleep as much, you know. But it's very hard when you're editing. You know, it's easier to multitask when you're producing and directing somebody else's film. You can do more than one film when you're producing and directing, because you know this. I mean, you got a team,
right?
You know, you got other associate producers, you got archival producers, you got editors. So you don't have to do everything yourself. You're not sitting there at the machine editing. You know. So
actually, Bill brought up a point that I didn't think about. At least for musicians, I feel like a lot of us made the full jump into Pro Tools at like around like 90, 92, 93, mm-hmm. and full-fledged like in mid to late 90s. But for the film world, when did that jump or that paradigm shift occur, like from digital editing to...
Around 94, 95. Yeah, I cut my last film. I cut the last piece on film for Spike in 96. It was Girl 6.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That was done on film?
That was done on film. Then after Girl 6, I never did anything else on film for Spike. I mean, Four Little Girls was digital. You know, Bamboozle was digital. Everything after that was digital.
How hard is that adjustment in learning new language, learning like programs?
You guys
gotta
steal all my questions all the time on every show.
Sugar Steve wants to know how Long hard face. Is it to learn? Steve, ask a question. I'm sorry.
Well, I just what was the transition like for you? Was it exciting or frustrating? Or
at first it was frustrating because I didn't think of myself as computer savvy, so I had to get up to speed on working on the computer and stuff and figuring out how to do things technically.
How old were you at that time?
45. Mm. So, it used to be, you could call Avid support all the time when you had questions. So the first film I cut on Avid, I think I was on Avid support every day. You know, oh, this doesn't work. How do I make this work? How do I do this? You know, Avid support. You know, I adjusted to it because I didn't want to stop editing. So, and I didn't want someone else to edit for me. So I learned how to do it digitally.
Did you find that you were able to be more creative with digital or than you were with film as an editor?
The big advantage to editing digitally is that, when you used to edit film, you want to recut a sequence a different way and save the old sequence. You'd have to either make a dupe of the old sequence and then unsplice all the shots to rebuild it another way. Digitally, you can do it in one way, and then you can just do another version and you keep the other one, And, that to me was like a great sort of plus. Ah, I can see three versions of my cut. Now, the issue, the challenge is if you sort of don't make a decision, then you say you got to see six versions of your cut. Because then you can't make a decision. So right. you got to be mindful of how many cuts you want to see before you say, okay, this is the one, maybe you make it
so real
adjustment. Yeah.
As far as the quality is concerned, I know that as a musician, even though I do use digital technology, I'm pretty much using that digital technology to make it sound like I'm doing analog.
Yeah,
trying to make it sound as cheap and whatever. Like, are you the type of editor or do editors in general still try to, I don't know, execute that same process as far as, you know, like we will use terms like, well, there's a warmth sound with analog that you don't get with digital, and it sounds cold. And is that the same with you?
Yeah, I mean, you're still trying to figure out, you know, in terms of your aesthetic, how to make it still feel like you're making a movie and you're not trying to do a commercial. You know, so you're crafting it in a certain way. So you're saying, this film aesthetic that I learned when it was film, I'm trying to apply that to the digital technology. You know, I'm trying not to edit films like what I would see, the fast-paced commercials or something on, you know, these music videos. I'm still trying to bring to it the storytelling, editorial storytelling techniques I learned when I was editing film, you know, and I try to still apply those, you know. And then it depends on who shoots your material. I mean, a lot of documentary filmmakers still have the ability to have their camera people shoot it so it's 24 frames per second. You know, it looks like you're shooting it on film. You know, sometimes you want to change the textures and the coloring of it so it has a more sort of filmic texture. You think about all those things, you know, when you're shooting these things. If you go and you watch some of these films I've done in the last few years, I still try to give it a sort of an emotional film sensibility in terms of the approach, you know.
That leads to my question. Okay, you brought up Bamboozled. Mm-hmm. So at the time when we shot that with Spike, and Spike was explaining to me that, yo, we're going to shoot this all on digital. And I think that was like new to him at the time. Like the way he shot that film was way different. So even watching him on the set and how him and was Malik his lensman? I'm not certain.
Alan Curris shot it.
Oh, okay. Now, when I saw that film and it was digital, it still had a, I don't know what to call the type of film that like they use when they do soap operas, but.
Well, it had that feel. Because that's what he wanted, you know.
Is that video or is that? But that's what I was asking. Was that done on purpose? Because then, you know, you cut to She Hate Me. She Hate Me still had a kind of, you don't know if it's video.
Yeah, or, so it had the video, so the old television show's texture. Mm. I know what you're talking about.
But now it's like, it's borderline, like it feels like it's 35 millimeter when I'm watching it. Like in the beginning, when I first got my digital TV, everything felt like a soap opera. Maybe like after 10 years of watching it, I've just conditioned myself to accept this is the norm. But are they still like rewriting the quality of what digital is?
Well, the thing you should remember, you know, with your TVs, you know, there's settings in your TV that makes
you got to set that frame rate.
You got to set the frame rate so it doesn't look like digital. Oh. You go to these hotels sometimes, you're watching things and say, man, that looks, you know.
It looks like a play, right?
Like a play.
Yeah. But
it's so proper, right.
Yeah, but if you set your frame rate on your television, it won't look like that. If you set it for 24 frames per second, it won't look like 30 frames per second.
Ooh, I love a good lesson. Let me go get my remote.
That's because on the new iPhones, like on the, because like I got the 12 Pro Max, and you can shoot 30 frames per second video, 4K, right. And then you can shoot 60 frames, and the 60 frames just
it's looks hella
like,
real. It's just hella.
It's just it's like nah, it looks plastic. Like it looks so real, it looked fake. It's crazy.
But the other thing too, you know,
I was wondering.
The other thing too is that with Bamboozled, Spike was shooting DV cameras, the first DV cameras, and the frame rate was 30 frames per second, but it really had a real digital feel. And what's happened with the cameras, those DV cameras, nobody uses those anymore. So the technology's improved. So now when you shoot with these video cameras, if you use the right lenses, you can feel like you're watching film. You know, it's the advanced kind of technology.
So if they were, well, I already know that they did a, like a
Criterion.
I know they did. Yeah, they already did a Criterion reissue. So what I'm asking is if there's a remastering process.
Yeah, well, it'll still look the same.
So you can keep it looking just like it did in 2000?
Yeah, because I just watched it too on Criterion. It looks the same. It looks just like it did when they shot it. They're not going to be able to change that look. That's the feel that they got, and it's not going to change.
So at the time when you were doing it and watching it, was it sort of off-putting Like, okay, is this going to be the future of movies now? Like, is everything going to look like?
Yeah, it was.
You know, I picked up a video camera and made it look like this, or
yeah, it felt a little off-putting. It definitely did, but you know, Spike was, you know, Spike did it for a couple of reasons. I mean, he had access to all these cameras. He shot with six cameras. You remember?
Yeah,
he shot with lots of cameras, and also it had an impact on the budget because shooting with those cameras, you didn't spend as much money if you were shooting on film. You know, he did shoot the performance stuff with, you know, with Tommy Davidson and Savion. He shot that on film, six Super 16. But everything else was video.
Okay, I see.
Yeah. What is a question I had? Just what is an example? And you don't have to, you know, name any particular movies if you don't want, but what is an example of just bad editing? Just kind of just, you know, just from a fundamental standpoint, because there's movies I watch and I'm just like, yeah, they felt like they could have cut maybe 10, 15 minutes out of that. It felt too long or whatever. Is bad editing?
I never say that anymore. You know,
okay.
But most films when you watch them, I watched a film the other night from 2015 with Sean Penn and Idris Elba and Javier Bardem called Gunman. You know, they shot all over the place. They shot in South Africa. They shot in Spain, Barcelona. They shot in England. And it's not a good film. It's not a good film at all. But it's not about the editing. It's not about the cinematography because it looks great. It's edited pretty well. The thing to remember is usually not bad editing. It's usually bad scripts.
Yeah, bad storytelling. Yeah.
It's bad storytelling, you know, because the technology has improved to such a degree that most films look fantastic. Most films are edited well. The problem is the story sucks. You know, so when the story sucks, it doesn't matter how well it's put together. It just doesn't work. You know, so I never really see that term bad editing anymore. You know, it's really just bad storytelling.
That was curious. For thanks for clearing it up, because I wonder, like, yeah, where does it get made? Is it the story, or is it?
It's the story.
Can you have a good story and then a bad cut can mess it up? You know, degree does it?
Rare. It's rare. You could, but it's rare. You can definitely have a bad story, and the cuts won't help it.
Well, I was going to say, what happens in the case of a film like The Irishman, which clearly I see more of it as a curtain call than I do a film. Like, I don't know if I would name The Irishman in my Scorsese, you know.
Forgot
top
about
five.
It already. Damn.
No. But the thing is that I enjoyed it, but I saw it more as a curtain call. Like, okay, this is obviously the last time we're going to see Pacino and De Niro and Scorsese and Schumacher. Like, at this level and this intensity of a gangster film. So it's kind of like, okay, I forgave the fact that it was 3 hours and 45 minutes or however long it was. But in your mind, but I'm also not a film buff. So there are a lot of things that I will let slide that a lot of my film buff films or friends will just start criticizing. Now, I know it might be sacrilegious or whatever, but what do you do what would you do in the case of a film like The Irishman, where?
Well, here's my take on The Irishman. And, you know, there's some people I know who love it, who absolutely love that film. To me, I feel like it was what I call Scorsese's sort of like the last trail. You know, this was his swan song. He'll make more films, but in terms of the gangster milieu, he should leave it alone. Because for me, it was too long, and I didn't buy the idea that Joe Pesci and De Niro look like young men.
Oh, my God. What is that effect?
Not at all.
What is
Not
this effect that doesn't work on everybody that they try?
It didn't work at all.
Sorry. It did not. No.
But wasn't that also like a primitive, like in my mind, is that bamboozled in 2000 where it's just like this new technology that they're working on, and obviously they'll...
You know, it could be one of those things where in 10 years, people will revisit that film and say it was a masterpiece. To me, it was too long, and it was a curtain call. And, you know, and I don't need to see De Niro or Joe Pesci play gangsters ever again. You know,
it's time.
Agreed.
You know, it was just, I'm a big fan of Marty's films, you know, Raging Bull and Goodfellas. even Casino, but this one was like,
This one
was like, okay, this is time to stop this journey. You know,
the one I will say, the thing I liked about it that I thought was interesting was that he, whereas his old films, you know, he was kind of shown as, you know, glorifying the gangster life with Casino and Goodfellas. You kind of see the shiny side of it.
Yeah.
But with this one, it was more so, for lack of a better term, it was just a blue collar gangster. Like, he wasn't rich. He wasn't.
Yeah,
he was just that. So I did think that that was an interesting shift, you know, tone wise. But I agree. I don't think we need to see them play gangsters. I think they have nothing new to say in that way.
And it was watching, you know, even the scene I remember the scene, Nero's character beats up the kicks the gangster in the street.
Dude, and he's like 80 years old.
Yeah, I said, this guy's an old man. I mean, he can barely lift his leg.
But I thought that like normally, especially if you watch Goodfellas and Casino, the way that Thelma does cuts and edits very intensely and things that, you know, trademarks that Scorsese's known for, this was the first time where I didn't see that fast-paced kind of editing action that makes it more intense. So I actually thought that unique for them to do a slower cut kind of Scorsese gangster film that wasn't.
Yeah, you could say that, or you could say that, you know, the other way to look at it, you know, is that sometimes, you know this, sometimes when an artist gets older, their rhythms and their paces slow down.
Mm.
You know?
Oh, see, I thought that was on purpose.
No, okay. I didn't.
You know, sometimes it is, but sometimes, I gave you a great example, you know. You know, I've been doing the Max Roach film, right?
Right.
And so you watch Max in the 40s and you listen to Max in the 40s and 50s of Clifford Brown. I mean, everything is. By the time you got to the 70s, and he's still playing, you know, he's doing opera, you know, his drum muscle losses, but you can tell it slowed down.
Right.
It slowed down. You know?
Wait, it's funny you said that. I had a moment. Probably one of Max's last public performances before he passed away, where they set up this drum thing between him and I. And I feel so fuckboyish recalling this story. You know, I was like, all right, I'm going up against Max Roach, man. I better prepare. So I spent a month working on my technique. No, well, the thing was, I had... going up against, I did this with Cindy Blackman.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe 7 months before.
Uh-huh.
But and you did it with Roy Haynes, too, and you learned.
This was 400. I did not battle Roy Haynes. But I'm just saying that with Cindy, one, I was way out of shape. I was like 400 pounds, whatever. And like 3 minutes into the solo, she just dusted me. And I was I was on my never again joint. And so... I was like, all right, Max Roach, I don't care. I'm going to dust his ass. And I didn't realize that he was like, you know, his late 80s and just.
Yeah, man.
He was just happy to be there. He like played a little tinky dinky 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 dinky. And I felt like an asshole at the end, like, oh, man, I was showing out.
And then I think, too, because by that point in your career, you don't really have anything left to prove. I mean, it's like, motherfucker, I'm Max Roach. Like, what? That's it. Yeah, you know what I mean? Right. If I can get I can play fucking spoons and bottles. You know what I mean? Like, whatever.
That's true. That's true. Exactly. That's absolutely true. Yeah.
So, I want to ask you about Style Wars. For a lot of hip hop aficionados, especially old school cats, like between Wild Style and Style Wars, those are the first, probably the two really authentic looks at early hip hop. Could you talk about getting involved in that project? And was it a big deal to you that sort of thing was greenlit to make in the first place?
Well, it was interesting. The director, Tony Silver, I was working for Victor Kineski, the guy who trained me. Right. And he had this editing service. And we had been doing trailers. Tony Silver used to do these movie trailers, these little 2-3 minute movie trailers. And we used to edit those for Tony. And then one day he said he had a buddy named Henry Chaffin, who would go up to the Bronx and Queens, and he would photograph in these all these graffiti artists doing their thing. And he decided to, Tony decided to take a camera crew and start shooting. And so he just started shooting all these guys, the breakdancing, all the artists, you know, all of them. And then he came to Victor and says, I got all this footage. I don't have a lot of money, but you guys, I'll pay you something so we can start editing. So in like 1981, 82, we started editing that film for not a lot of money, you know, and I knew about the whole hip hop world, you know, I knew about graffiti, but this was a deep dive. It took us a whole year to edit that film, you know, because Tony was always changing every cut we made. He would look at a cut and say, oh, this is not right, this is not working. Which we edit, we restructure, And by the time that whole year was over, editing that film, I was so angry and disgusted with Tony, I didn't want to see him again.
You
know? Yeah, because we just worked so hard on it. We really worked hard. And, you know, I never realized that the film would really take off like it did. You know, we knew that it was an audience, but we didn't realize we really had such a big splash. I mean, even today, I mean, I've had students, you know, in the last 10 years who've seen that film. I mean, even Spike said he didn't know I edited that film after I did No Better Blues. And he saw my credits with it. You edited, you one of the editors on Star Wars? But yeah, man, you know.
So you had no clue that this was something revolutionary, like not?
I knew it was revolutionary, but I didn't realize it was going to have such a wide-reaching impact. You know, because when we finished it, Tony took it away and we knew it got in some festival. You know, we didn't, you know, back then when I was editing films, I didn't think much about how where they were going to go so much. I was just, it was, you know, I was trying to make a good film and then move on. So okay. it was one of those things you said, wow, it really had impact.
I guess that said, for me, the film seems so guerrilla-like. Like, did it have... Did they at least go into the project with some sort of like plan or map, or was it just like, we'll just shoot as we go along and try to make, create a story out of this? Cause it wasn't like they were there to teach us the history. It was almost like a reality show. So to speak.
It was guerrilla work. I mean, sometimes they would go to these yards and they would shoot the guys doing their thing. Sometimes they did have a little bit of a plan. Like when Case went into his house, you know, when you see Case walking through the projects, walking through the playground, walks through his house, the camera pans all pans up. They decided to do that. Then they went upstairs and they sat down with Case and his two buddies and had them drawing, and Case is telling you his story about how he lost his arm and stuff.
Right.
And then seeing when those guys are on the train, when Case and his guys up on the L train, you know. And then, you know, like when we did that montage, that was sort of Tony said, let's do a montage. Let's figure out a montage. So we found that song when they're saying, you know, they're doing that rap.
Right.
And found the music and we just created it. Some of these things were spontaneous. Some of these things were a little set up. But most of it was guerrilla type filmmaking.
Well, when you're in that situation, what happens if you're, I assume that if you're editing already, you're at least towards the end stage or the fourth quarter of the project. What if you're in a situation in which you have like way more broth than you have stew content for that particular meal? In other words, like if you're editing and you're trying to create a sort of coherent storyline and it's not all the way there yet, like do you guys go back out to shoot some more stuff
reshoots?
Yeah, sometimes if they have the budget and you can get them to go back out, they do reshoots. Sometimes if they don't have the budget, then you got to improvise even more to figure out how to make it coherent and work. If you have more broth than stew ingredients, you know. Okay. So the thing you always have to remember when you're making a film is always keep on your toes with the surprises. Never settle into the idea that, oh, this is going to be the material I have. I got to make it work this way. You can always, with film, it's really malleable. You can try different things all the time to come up with different ways to look at a sequence. You know, okay. And a really good filmmaker will always be open to trying different things. Because if you're not, then someone's going to take it from you and say, well, you know, there's another way. Because there's always another way to make a film. Always.
Okay.
Can you talk about your relationship with composers and music editors?
I mean, we just recently interviewed Terrence Blanchard, who I'm sure you know, and I've been working on a bunch of films lately, and I find that that relationship is always very different as editors. Some usually work with the same composer, some don't, and just figuring out that situation and how to achieve the best possible thing and what comes first, music or not music, what are you using, yada, yada, yada. That's what I'm
interested in. Usually my process is, you know, I'll put a cut together. Like, I just finished this other film for HBO called Black Art in the Absence of Life about these different artists from Carrie Mae Weems to Carol Walker to Carrie James Marshall. Mm-hmm. So we put the film together and the editor said, what kind of temp music do you want to use? I said, well, there's a composer out in LA named Catherine Bostic and I want to use her music. So she had done the music for my August Wilson film. So I said, let's go back and I had her send me some of that music that she had done for the August Wilson film. So let's use some of your music as temp. Oh, send me some other pieces that you can use as temp. And then we laid in some of her music. Some of it worked, some of it didn't work. But when we got to a cut where we had some of this temp music in it, then I had some other music that I found that I liked that I used. I used some Coltrane music. I used some Billy Strayhorn, which I knew I couldn't keep because it was going to cost too much money. So then we had a music session where I said to Catherine, you know, here's the feel I'm looking for. Here's the tonalities. You know, and I play an instrument, so I'm always talking about, here's the kind of instruments I want you to try. I want flutes here. I want woodwinds here. I think you should have.
What do you play? What's your instrument?
I play flute. I used to play saxophone a little too. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So you know, and you know, so I'm talking about the rhythm and the pace and the tonality. Now, some people, you know, some directors don't know music, can't use musical terms. They say, you know, I want it to be strong.
It's blue or black or yellow.
But I try to give them some real specifics. So I'll say, like, I'm talking to this composer now about this Art Bash film. And I said, you know, man, we're trying to create that 70s feel. So go back, that 60s and 70s feel. Go back and listen to the scores that Quincy Jones did for In the Heat of the Night and a 1968 film called The Pawnbroker. Listen to that rhythmic feel. Listen to the rhythm and the pacing of that. I want that kind of feel for this score, for this film, you know. You know, and we're keeping some music that we have in the film now. When Arthur Ashe goes to South Africa, we're going to use Gil Scott-Heron's Johannesburg, you know, and we're going to use The Temptations, How I Wish It Would Rain, you know. But so listen to those pieces to see if you can sort of instrumentally replicate that feel for some of the other sections of the film. So I'm trying to be very specific with composers. You know,
now the fact that you can speak music and film, that goes a long way.
It helps. It really helps.
Yeah.
For me, of all your work with Spike Lee, I will say, and it's weird, and I hope, you know, this statement isn't hyperbolic or timely, only because the film has not been seen in 30 years. For some reason, he hasn't allowed it on streaming or whatever, but for me at the time in 91 watching that Taj Mahal scene Jungle Fever, to me that was of all of in Spike's whole canon, I don't think 6 minutes really hasn't gripped me or frightened me as much as watching that film. Like, it wasn't over exaggerated, and oftentimes, you know, Spike will hammer point home with over exaggeration or that sort of thing, but it was just like to watch that scene in its 6 minute glory, like to the backdrop of Stevie Wonder's Living for the City and the way that was edited and all that stuff. Could you talk about just the choreography of how that scene came to be?
I think, you know, you'd have to ask Spike this, but I think he played that music when he was shooting that scene.
Because
what's interesting to me about when I cut that scene and Spikey said he wanted to use Living in the City, I don't think I made a music cut. You know, usually, really? I don't think I made a music cut. I know if you go back, you guys watch the Love Supreme at the end of Mo' Better Blues, I made a big music cut there. You know, between when the baby's
baby's born.
I made a big music cut there. But on Living in the City, I don't think I made a music cut.
What do, you, almost, Now, Sam, you know you got to break that down because I'm like, wait, music. What are you saying? A music cut or a music cart?
A music cut where you say, where you remove some of the music to make it work with
to
the
make
scene.
It work in the scene. Yeah.
But this one, I don't think I made any music cuts living in the city because
with the exception of the occasional cut of them smoking crack across the screen, it almost felt like it was one long take. But I know that you use multiple.
I use multiple visual takes. But I'm talking about, I didn't make any music edits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the music was, it played straight through.
Yeah, it played straight through, right.
Yeah, usually I make a music edit because the sequence is too long. But the two films where I never made a music edit was on that one and the sequence in Girl 6 when What's-Her-Name is going to the beach and
How come you don't call me anymore?
Yeah. How come you don't call me? Man, and I love that fucking scene.
That's heartbreaking.
I love that scene too, man. I don't think I made a music cut.
You know, was that the first catfish on film, Fonte?
Might have been.
The first Twitter flyout story going wrong.
Might have been. No, it was almost like Spike had shot that scene in a pace and a rhythm that I didn't have to. I made all these individual picture cuts that worked, but it was like they were just right. Everything was just right. I was like, wow, I couldn't believe it.
At one point, I borderline felt like he started with Living for the City and then somehow like wrote the film around that.
That's what I think he did. That's exactly what I think he did, Amir. I think he started with the song and he then built the scene from that. Because that's how it works.
And dress. Okay. Yeah, because it's just so unusual to, and again, Living for the City is like 6 minutes long, but I just wondered how, with editing is concerned, like how is he, like, because the timing has to be perfect, because literally, for those that haven't seen the film, there's a scene where Flipper Purify, played by Wesley Snipes, has to confront his brother for stealing the TV. Yeah. Sam Jackson playing a crackhead, his older crackhead brother, Flipper?
Gator.
Gator and Flipper.
Matter of fact, I believe that Cons had to invent a category just so that Sam Jackson could win Best Supporting Actor. They didn't have a supporting scene. So basically what happens is Wesley Snipes starts at one point in Harlem and does a real-time walk, what seems to be four blocks or whatever, to a crack house, a crack den, of which once he gets there, you know, especially for 91 when people were still had their heads in the sand over the crack epidemic, like to visually see that shot. I'm really shocked we didn't even ask Spike about the scene when he was on the show twice. Damn. I forgot, but
doesn't it pause in the middle when Wesley has the conversation with was it Charlie Murphy?
No, the music's
not Charlie.
Still going.
Okay.
No, so even, the music's still going.
Music's still going.
Right. Wow. So I guess what I wanted to like, did they have to choreograph that?
Wow.
In terms of, or was that just great editing? Because as far as I know, Wesley Snipes starts four blocks ahead, walks to the Taj Mahal four blocks later, confronts Halle Berry and Sam Jackson. And, you know, of course, this has to work in coordinates with the song, you know.
And stopping to talk to Charlie.
That's what I'm saying. I think Spike played the track while he was shooting.
Because it
almost worked so perfect when I cut it. I couldn't believe how it worked so well.
Right. Yeah. That to me is like one of his, if I don't know. And again, I don't know timing wise if it still could work in 2021. Beg him all the time, like, why is this the only film of yours that's not, you know, available for screening?
What does he say?
I don't know. I you know, and it's weird. I've done some you know, I've read a few blogs or whatever, and they'll try to say like, well, you know, this is his only film that wasn't as timely, or you know, that sort of thing, like it didn't age well, or that sort of, I don't know, but he sort of just, he's shruggish about it. But for me, I don't know. I between that scene and the final scene with Ozzie Davis and Sam Jackson, I thought that was some of his most powerful.
Yeah. yeah,
visuals there.
Yep.
So, I want to jump into you as a director, not just as an editor. As I mentioned at the top, with Eyes on the Prize 2, the aforementioned Jesus and the Black Messiah film is based.
Judas and the Black Messiah.
Judas. Oh, I'm sorry. I keep saying Jesus.
You ain't the only one. It's a.
Wait a minute. I've went on record in other places publicly and said Jesus, and no one has ever corrected me.
Because he is.
That's because we weren't there. That's because we weren't there, and that's what we do. We correct you. That's why
that's
we're here.
That's the worst. Anyway, so they use the footage from your documentary interviewing, I forget his name.
William O'Neill.
Yeah, William O'Neill. And of course, they also note that he commits suicide the day that Eyes on the Prize finally
released.
Gets televised. At the time, why did you choose to include him in your film? And was he as brash as that clip seemed to be? He kind of spoke with like no remorse, like, well, at least I did something.
I think he was. I think he was conflicted, and you know, I think he was a complicated man. And when you know, because I didn't produce that particular segment, but I was on the series. And
I thought you directed that.
That one I didn't direct, but and you know, the producer whose voice is really asking the question was a woman, you know. So it's, you know, I think he was a conflicted man. I just think he was torn, as you can see in the film. And it caught up with him emotionally and psychically, you know.
And also, too, they just didn't show, not that they didn't show it in the movie, but I think a lot of times context is lost on just how young they were when they got involved doing this shit.
He was caught up between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah.
You know? So, you know, he was a conflicted man. So it's a sad story, quite honestly, very sad.
Yeah.
So with MLK FBI, what prompted you to even return to the story to investigate the story? Because I guess for a lot of people, you know, there's sort of a fatigue on civil rights and how many ways we can tell the story. How did you know that there was another story to tell that we weren't aware of?
It was a book. We read this book by David Garrow, a historian, about the surveillance of King by the FBI and Hoover, and we thought it would be a good story. If we told it right, we thought we could make it work. And, you know, the reality is that I don't think there's going to be a fatigue on stories about King or Malcolm or even, you know, Fred Hampton. I mean, there's always an appetite. This is history now. This is 40 years, almost 50 years ago. So this has become really important history. So we thought we could give it a new spin.
You did.
And that's what we did. You know, that's why we did it. You know, it was a new way to tell the story.
How did you, as far as the film concerns, it really gets deep into how the FBI tries to intimidate and manipulate and use propaganda against King, especially his kind of philandering, if you will, with other women and that sort of thing. Was there any apprehension whatsoever to sort of let that cat out of the bag, even though these things are
already
on record? I know they're on record, but I don't think the average Joe like says, "Hey, I'm gonna go to the FBI and
there were reservations. You know, we talked about it. You know, we felt like, you know, what's going to happen if we put this stuff in? You know, are we going to be doing this disservice of the FBI? And we talked about it constantly, but we knew that if we left it out, someone would say, well, you guys really just, you know, tried to clean this up and not
whitewash
Dr. King. Yeah, whitewash it. So, you know, we talked about it. We tried different versions of the section about the supposed rape until we felt we were being responsible as filmmakers. So, you know, it's never, sometimes the decisions you make are never easy, but you have to make a decision. And that's that. When we said, okay, let's make the decision, we're going to put it in, we're going to try to be responsible filmmakers and tell it in a way that doesn't seem salacious.
Were there things that you discovered in, first of all, what is the research, besides the book, how much personal research do you as director have to do? And not just like, okay, your team or that sort of
thing? No, you got to read books. You got to read articles. You know, you try to do as much research as you can so you understand the subject you're going to tackle. And then you bring on an archival producer to help you find the material that you think can help visualize and orally tell the story, you know. So you always, I mean, when you're making these films, you got to do homework. You know, you could do homework. You could do homework on any of these documentaries for 2 or 3 years before you make the film. But sometimes you get schedules and you have to sort of do it faster, you know. So I read the book. I read some of the letters. I read some of the Freedom of Information Act material, you know, and Ben did also. So we knew what we were doing, you know.
Did the King family have, given who you are, did they have any like heads up or
no
have any conversation? Okay, hey.
No, because we know the King family is litigious. You know, they're looking to make money, you know, and when they're making money is, you know, we knew that they want to charge for any time you see Dr. King's image or hear his voice. Yeah. And, you know, the amazing thing, you know, is that they didn't shoot that footage. It was shot by networks and stuff like that, but they feel a proprietary sort of, you know, ownership of their father's image and his sound.
This brings up a good subject because we asked this of Mike Africa and Will, I'm sorry, the director's...
Tommy Black. I'm about to say Tommy Mottola.
Tommy. Right. Oliver? Was his last name Oliver?
Tommy Oliver. Tommy Oliver. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Who did their documentary. And it's interesting that people, laymen don't understand how people get paid for like their appearances in documentaries and things of that nature. And I kind of learned a little on this process of Amir doing songs that shook, but just of archival and breaking down like how it's not really a money-making situation with documentaries. Right, like you shouldn't be thinking in that way, but when you do, there's a way, there's a different way of doing things. Am I wrong in saying that?
Well,
it's correct me. Say it correctly if I'm not.
Yeah, you should never think you're going to make a documentary to make money, because that rarely ever happens.
But even some of the participants who feel like they're a part of this story and this project is going to make money. So if I'm seen on camera, then I should make a lot.
I deserve a piece.
Yes.
Yeah, but you see, but
even
see,
if they break the record for a highest documentary,
no,
I'm playing. I'm playing.
The rule of thumb is you should never pay a subject to do a documentary.
Thank you. That's it.
I found out something in this process. Okay, well, I found out that if the subject is the executive producer of the project, like that's kind of a conflict of interest. So that.
Oh, that's right.
In other words, like because Wu-Tang insisted on being the executive producers of that documentary,
right?
They're not eligible for, you know, like award season. Like for, I guess that would be an Emmy thing. They wouldn't be eligible. And also, you cannot pay yourself. You can't pay a subject to be a talking head.
However,
However, I found out there's a slight. I don't know if this is the magician giving away.
That's
a
what
secret.
I was thought I was doing when I said the archival thing, right? Like,
yeah, you could pay if someone has something that you wanted to use in your film, archival or stills.
You say archival.
Right.
You're paying. You're licensing their material. That you can do.
Yeah, but I will say that's a loop around it. You can.
Yeah, that's
do archival.
Loop.
Okay, that's
sort
right.
of things.
Just yeah. Make sure. Folks,
but I'm never going to pay you, Leah.
I got some good archival, though. I got some Mac Roaches stuff. Let me get it together.
Yeah, that may change it, though.
Dang.
So, Sam, I just want to talk about the upcoming projects you have. Well, in particular, the Negro League project that you're proposing. So since you're at the beginning of it, what in your mind, do you already have an outline of what you want to achieve, or is it still a thing where you have to see what you're given and then add to it later? Or
it's a combination of both. I mean, in the case of the Negro Leagues, we know we have, you know, Bob Motley, Brian's father, to help tell that story, right? Mm-hmm. I've been reading his book again. So we know we're going to have elements from his life to tell that story. And then the other element I know that we're going to have to tell this story is the archival images, footage, and stills to tell the story. And we also have this box full of interviews that Byron did over the years that I'm going to use. And in this particular case, because some of it's not shot so well, I'm going to use it as audio. I'm going to use it as audio only, Amir.
Okay.
I don't want to see some of these people on camera. I'm going to do it audio to help tell that story, you know. And the other element that I, you know, you've heard me say this, is to create these impressionistic recreations of the fields, of the places they played, of the locker rooms they were in, to give you a sense of that experience. To make it, my attitude is to try to make this film as poetic and informative as possible, you know, in a different way than I did MLK FBI. This one I wanted to have more poetry. You know, this whereas I want the music to sort of, you know, replicate the period that this the Negro Leagues evolved through, you know. So that'll take me back to there was a great musician for my taste, you know, from the early 30s, you know, what's his name? Ernie Fields. He had a great jump band in the 30s, and his music would be absolutely appropriate for the Negro Leagues. You know, even quite honestly, you know, Count Basie's early bands come out of that Southwest feel. You know, that would be a great feel for that period also. You know, when you had Herschel Evans and Lester Young, you know, and Ben Webster. You know, so my head's already thinking the kind of musical template I want to use to help tell this story.
My final question is there a film project that you long to do that you haven't? And that also includes non-documentary stuff as well. Like, is there a fantasy film that you want to knock out the box?
Well, you know, I got the Max Roach film, which is almost done. Tweaking now. And if there was a fantasy film I had to do, man, you know, I was listening to... I would do a film not about Blue Note Records. I would do a film about the musicians who were part of Blue Note Records, but who had a style that sort of changed from what I call that hard bop period to the post Coltrane McCoy Tyner period. Listening to people like Joe Henderson and Sonny Rollins, you know, and Freddie Waits. You know, because I'm so into the music. That's my head always, you know.
Okay, so basically the stuff that Ken didn't cover in his PBS documentary.
Exactly right, man. Exactly right. No Joe Henderson, man. No Freddie Waits, you know.
Yeah, I get it. Well, Sam, I thank you for coming on the show. We really appreciate it.
It was fun. It was fun, guys. And
thank you.
Nah, this was super fun. Yeah, man. And if you see Brent Owens, tell him I said what up.
Give me that rap again, man, for the opening.
Pimps on a stroll, hoes on the roll. Meet Candy. She's looking dandy. On a Friday night, everyone knows the names change, but the game remains the same.
I don't know who you are anymore, Fonte.
Oh, I do. That's my
I do not know who you are.
Tickle-o.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Who scored? Who scored? Who goes at the point? Anybody? Anybody?
It was Kenny Barron.
Yeah.
Wow.
That is so crazy.
Because Brent Owens' brother is Jimmy Owens, the trumpet player.
Good night. Good night. Hookers at the point.
Yes.
That is crazy. All right. Guys. Well,
take care.
On behalf of Laia, Sugar Steve, Unpaid Bill, and Fonte, and thank you, Sam Pollard, it's Questlove signing off. We will see you on the next go round of Questlove Supreme. Thank you.
Be good. Take care, everybody.
Peace, y'all. Yo, what's up? This is Fonte. Make sure you keep up with us on Instagram at QLS and let us know what you think and who should be next to sit down with us. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. All right? Peace.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.